This open. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to go a little bit out of order today with some public hearings and work sessions. We will start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 523. Senator Johnson is here, and while she makes it up to the stand, maybe we could get a quick briefing on this bill.
Sure. So, Chair Haas, members of the committee, Senate Bill 523 allows Department of Revenue to post information about debtors on their website, including information on their name, city, state, type of debt, and amount of debt due. It requires that this information be removed within 14 days of any debt resolution.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I thank you for hearing this bill. I had prepared testimony today, but received an email that I plan to share with you that makes the case. Regrettably, I do not know the author, so I can't give credit to the Oregonian that sent it to me. However, it captures the essence of this bill perfectly. We applaud the legislature for considering this bill to make public the names of Oregonians who are seriously delinquent in paying their state taxes. With this measure, we join more than half of our fellow states in using public shame to press citizens into paying their taxes after a long series of earnest and costly efforts have failed. California successfully names and shames individuals and corporations who owe at least $100,000 in state taxes. Most other states post the names of taxpayers whose unpaid debt is more than $20,000. Oregon has relied on debt collectors to go after these scofflaw citizens. Adding shame to our arsenal of persuasions is long overdue. In our democracy, the costs of the common welfare are met by individuals and businesses who pay their fair share of taxes, which means in proportion to their ability and according to the same rules. By keeping secret how much they pay or have not paid on their taxable income, their social debt is not known. This is not fair. Senate Bill 523 is a step towards rectifying the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. I remember when I was a little kid, and sometimes we go into the grocery store, and up behind the cash register, there'd be little signs that said, "Do not take a check from this person," that bounced. And it's so embarrassing to those people. I get the intent of what you're trying to do.
If there are technical questions, I have my lifeline in the back of the room.
Yeah. How do I say this, Delic? I mean, this is just devil's advocate, just the thing that comes up. The Department of Revenue sometimes makes mistakes. It's been known to happen. I know you find that hard to believe. But if there were a mistake on someone who did pay their taxes and still got shamed, is, I think, a valid concern that's been raised. What would your response be to that?
Well, I think that is a legitimate concern. You raise a good point. I would hope that there would be a way to undo that. Lots of entities make mistakes. Newspapers print retractions. You're a former professional journalist. Errors are corrected in a public way. We had a committee hearing just a couple of days ago wherein there had been some debate and a solution was identified and the solution came forward on the record. So I imagine that we can figure out mechanisms to rectify this. I personally believe that the benefit far outweighs the downside. And I would assume that if there was a public apology from the state of Oregon for some taxpayer who had legitimately honored their obligations and was called out, that that would be a powerful form of apology.
Other questions for Senator Johnson? Senator Boquist, did you?
No, I think it's a great idea. I just want to know, do we get credit for, if we make revenue off this, do we get credit for raising revenue off this committee so that we can get a check done in Ways and Means? And I do see the DOR standing up there with bated breath in the back, willing to come up and talk about this.
Yeah. Okay. And this has a referral, or is that the next?
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Yeah.
In consultation with Ms. Mack, for whom I have the highest regard, she indicated to me that there may be a modest fiscal with respect to some of the DOR processes to accomplish this. It has not been priced. When I originally authored the draft, I did not think that there would be a fiscal, but if it's appropriate to refer it to Ways and Means, that would be a complete prerogative of the committee, and I would hope that it would fare well there.
You know people there.
I know people.
Other questions, Senator Riley?
Just a comment. I know when I was growing up, we had a shame in our newspaper quite often at, right after taxes. Not for me, but I always liked to look and see who my now my neighbors were doing. So I saw my cousins quite often.
Mr. Chair, if I can make one last comment. I do believe that this is a powerful tool. And once upon a time in legislative history, the real estate agency printed even the most minor transgressions of practicing real estate professionals in their newsletter. And it had a very deleterious effect on some people's professional credentials. Conversely, it alerted the community to some very bad practitioners. So I'm aware that this is a sword that cuts two ways, but for those of us that honorably discharge our responsibility of paying our taxes, it makes me pretty fill-in-the-blank mad to know that there are scoff laws that don't, and the rest of us carry their burden.
Yeah.
Thank you very kindly for the courtesy of coming out of order, and I hope you act favorably on this fine piece of public policy.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Do we have anyone else signed up on this?
Do you want DOR to come up to answer your question?
They have not initiated a...
Well, I would like DOR to come up so they can answer your question, because I want to put this in the newspaper or wherever so we can collect some more money.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And to answer your specific question about whether someone would be posted on this list by mistake, I think that I'm sure it's possible, but I think it's highly unlikely. The length of time that it takes to get to a level of this kind of delinquency, they've had dozens of notices, dozens of payment plans that have been broken, dozens of attempts to pay potentially. We also would send them a letter of our notice of intent to post them on this site, so that would give them a period of time to cure. So if they were incorrectly, even at that last minute, they would still have the opportunity to say, no, this is all wrong, you got it all wrong. And we could address it before it ever got posted. But there is a period of time where once it is cured, we can remove it immediately. So answer your question.
That's a good answer.
Okay.
Senator Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there are other situations where tax liens are filed in the public record. We get a flyer every other week that lists all of the folks against whom tax liens have been filed. It comes through the title companies. Mm-hmm. So this does not sound as though it's a one-off. This sounds like it's happening in other spaces. Is that true? If so, can you tell us what other spaces this is already being done?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bence, we do record liens on people who owe debt to the state to secure our line, in particular in real estate transactions, and the title companies do have access to that information. Those people aren't necessarily the same that would be posted. They're not the top, whatever 100 or top 200 or however many you decide in this policy. We record those as a matter of routine to secure our place in line. But they're not necessarily in a list, if that makes sense.
Follow up. So the question is one of whether or not this is a public matter, and whether or not in certain circumstances when people haven't paid their taxes, it's made public for whatever reason.
Right.
So, and I know it is, I just don't know how many other circumstances exist where that's the case.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bence, the other place that I can think of off the top of my head besides showing up in title reports is on a credit report in the judgment section of a credit report. It'll show up that a tax lien has been filed. We do not report to credit bureaus on like the installment side, on that side of the world, because it's kind of like fitting a square peg into a round hole. Tax debt is not monthly, it's not installment, it's not revolving debt, if that makes sense. So it shows up when we record it in a county record somewhere as a lien in a judgment section of a credit report. But that has to be pulled. There's no central place for it to be. People just can't pull someone else's credit report, if that makes sense.
Yes, this particular practice of calling out interactions between individuals and government. What I'm reminded of is traffic citations, violations, and other things that are published in the local paper, mm-hmm. So that everybody can see who got a ticket. I've never, I guess everybody reads that just to see, like we just heard, what neighbor got a ticket. But that, this, does this have anything, any parts that's different than that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benz, I think it does, in the sense that, at least anecdotally from our sister states, they've said that they've reported that there's more bang from the buck from the notice of intent to post, that people are afraid of being posted, so they'll pay, they'll find, they'll free up money, they'll take it out of that trust. Wherever they have the assets sheltered that we can't get to, they tend to pay for it. That's anecdotal evidence from other states. We did do a pilot project, and a lot of the payments that we got as part of it were involuntary, meaning we were getting them from garnishment sources or other means. But we did get some voluntary payments as a result of the pilot project that we did a couple years ago.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Senator Bocas.
Just a ballpark, refresh me. What's our indebtedness right now?
Oh, boy. Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I think it's been updated, but I really hate to throw a number out there. I know last year it was 3.3. It might be 3.7 billion total owed to the state and citizens.
So it's over a billion.
Tax debt, probably pretty close to a billion. Yes, sir.
All right. So we got the top 100 or 200 to throw in the pot for once. We might actually have some real money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this says it would be posted on the website. What would you anticipate would follow? In other words, reposted where? What can you predict the trail of under today's electronic environment? What happens?
Chair Haas and Senator Benz, I think that what happened with our pilot project is the media came in and tried to go and collect it themselves, basically, and go and knock on doors. And some of the businesses were no longer in business, and we had asserted personal liability against officers. And they didn't know those people's addresses because we didn't post the information that we had that was most current, because our current disclosure laws, which this bill would address, didn't allow us to post anything but what was recorded on the warrant in the county lien record, because at that point in time, it became public information. As you're aware, everything on the tax return is confidential. It's a Class C felony if we were to disclose it. And so we could only post what was already in the public record in a centralized location. Also, the media tried to get at our underlying list to identify who we picked from the bigger list that we sent notices to, which kind of takes the air out of the balloon if that's public and it goes public anyway. So this bill also addresses the public records component of that list. That's what I think would happen, is what basically happened in the pilot project.
Obviously, since you're well versed in this, I'm just curious, is there a best practices for line 15, which is, you know, greater than what XYZ?
You know,
on the other states, is it, you know, you should owe more than, yeah, I don't know, $1 million or $25 or.
Senator,
what do other states do, since you're your colleagues in the other states?
Chair Haas and Senator Boquist, California, I think the Senator Johnson, she testified it was $100,000, top 500 over $100,000. Looks like Colorado has anything greater than $20,000, and the warrant is at least six months old. Connecticut, maybe this is Delaware, I can't really read it very well, anything over $1,000. Some states post all delinquent amounts. Some are $25,000. $2,500. They're all over the board, depending on their own policies within the state. Now, Oregon, you know, Oregon is allowed, taxpayers are allowed to be delinquent, and they're entitled to a payment plan. So some of the things that you would consider, and I think that Senator Johnson did consider in this bill, is that if they're in bankruptcy, they're not going to go on the list. If they're in a payment a plan that we've approved, they're not going to go on the list. So the amount wouldn't really matter if they're doing the things that they're entitled under the law to do to make good on the debt that they owe us.
Well, Mr. Chair, but considering the cost of computerization, i.e. putting this on the web, right, I'm assuming there must be some threshold or number or something that's some amount that we don't want to have more than this or less than this or so on and so forth. And then I guess the second question, is there a way to sort of, you know, at least for LRO's perspective, to kind of provide a balance of, like, you know, if it was 100,000 on average, you might have X number of postings, or am I making any sense there?
No, Senator, Chair Haas and Senator Boquist, I think that we actually probably could find out, like, a table somehow, right, of the balances and the number of debtors for the different programs.
Mm-hmm.
to help guide you in that
right,
policy choice.
Right, because you guys are going to implement it, so we can make up all the wish lists we want. I did this in transportation. You made a wish list, and you did a really good job. But as you know, the wish list was too big for what was really practical. And that's sort of what I'm driving at, if we assume this is a good idea, which the committee is not, then the question is what sort of the parameter is there? Do you want to put a couple hundred up, or you have a threshold or this? And if we do that, it costs, you know, $3 gazillion to fix the computer to do it. But if you go more than this...
One of the things, Senator Haas and or Chair Haas and Senator Boqvist, that we learned from the pilot project is that we chose too small of a number. We only posted 50. And that number, actually, not enough people in that 50 cured to allow anyone else to come onto the list, if that makes sense. So it basically stayed static. So that's definitely something we need to think about if we go down this path, is how many do you really want to have posted? What's the amount? That kind of thing, to see if it really makes a difference.
Well, Mr. Chair, 10% of a billion is $100 million, which is a lot of money when we all have to vote for these things for tax increases. So I'm game for anything that might work. So I'd really like them to go down the list and kind of come back with an idea how to do this. Well, even if we say no.
Bring a table.
Yeah, and I think so. And what I, you know, when we typically when we have bills here, Deanna, you're like, well, we have some real issues here. We, you know, or you say, yeah, this we can do this. And I'm not hearing any issues here. It's just
I think, Senator,
not that you come out in favor of bills, but
yeah. Chair Haas, yeah, we can't. We're neutral on policy, but to administer this, yeah, there's some tweaks that could be done with this bill to make it. But really, I think Senator Johnson reached out to us ahead of time to identify some of the constraints that we would have, how it could be simpler than it was in the pilot project. The pilot project we did was completely manual because our current system has, like I mentioned earlier, it has the county records have the warrant information, but we record those warrants, you know, maybe even years ago, and the person has maybe made payments or the balance has changed or they've moved. And so our system has more updated information. So this bill addresses the issues that we had with the pilot. And it for the most part, I think there's still some technical concerns with it that we can work through. But she did work with us ahead of time to identify what the constraints were and how we could administer it. So I don't really have anything to say about it being... Right. Troublesome.
Well, you can see there's some interest on this committee in pursuing this. So to the extent you can engage with Senator Johnson and Legislative Revenue Office on a possible amendment.
Okay.
Encourage it. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Haas. In the past, I've had some bills around this subject and worked with Deanna and Diarra and with Senator Johnson, and this is actually an excellent, excellent idea. This is definitely used in other states, and we should do this. There's really no downside to doing this at all. I struggle to think of what the downside is to expanding this and trying it, and if we need, we can come back and make some changes, but those are my 2 cents.
Thank you. Senator Banks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if you're coming back with a report or something further, I would very much be interested in that previous question I asked, which was, if you put it on your website, what happens next? What other websites does it show up on? Where does it go? Because the so-called public shaming element suggests that it's in the local newspaper. It's showing up someplace where it's actually shaming people. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that being on your website is adequate for that purpose. So maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know what the measure of public shame is or how one understands what happens. So that's why I'd be interested in that.
And Chair Haas and Senator Benz, just really the experience we had from the pilot was the media. They took it and they ran articles and stories with it. So I don't know where else it would go after that. But that was our outcome from the pilot that we ran. I don't know that my answer. I'll find out. I'll confirm with my comms shop, with our communications shop, to make sure. But I think that was what happened.
Right. Well, the media has changed considerably over the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the newspapers aren't what they used to be. And so I would like to know a broader definition of the media. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can't force the media to do it, but it seems like something that would be of interest, especially in those lean pages. Thank you, Deanna.
You're welcome.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 523 and move to a public hearing and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 193, Interstate Broadcasters. Is this yours too? Okay, would you kindly give us a short update briefing?
Sure. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Senate Bill 193 makes permanent the customer domicile apportionment method for interstate broadcasters. It excludes the following entities from the definition of interstate broadcaster and thus that method of apportionment: cable system operators, direct broadcast satellite system operators, and television or radio stations licensed by the FCC.
Okay, I detect it's a little bit more complicated than that, but we'll go into it as far as we can. Let's start with some people who have signed up here. Melissa Patrick and John Wirtz.
John Powell.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Motion Picture Association of America, and have two guests to make this very simple and understandable. And the first that I'm going to introduce is Melissa Patak. She is Vice President and Senior Counsel, State Government Affairs for the Motion Picture Association of America. And I can tell you that Melissa is a pleasure to work with, a hard worker, keeps us on the straight and narrow. And Melissa is going to introduce the Motion Picture Association of America and who they are.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Patak with the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America. We represent the major producers and distributors of movies and TV shows. Our member companies are Disney, Fox, Netflix, Paramount Pictures, Sony Pictures, and Warner Brothers. I think I got, and Universal Studios, NBC Universal. We're here today because the affiliates of our member companies are the broadcasters, and we're here to talk about the apportionment method for them. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague John Wirtz, who's come from New York, and he's with Viacom, and he will explain the bill and the apportionment method. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas, Vice Chair Benz, and members of the committee. My name is John Wirtz. I am Vice President and Senior Tax Counsel at Viacom, Inc. I'm here on behalf of the company and Motion Picture Association of America and its member companies, who are the owners of all the major television broadcast networks and most of the national cable program networks currently operating in the U.S. We strongly support SB 193, which continues the customer location method of apportioning the income of national broadcast companies and national cable program companies. Customer location or commercial domicile apportionment formula is market sourcing for broadcast companies. Our customers, advertisers, such as Oregon-based companies, Nike, Columbia Sportswear, and Adidas. Our customers also include cable and satellite operators and local television stations that license the programming produced by our networks. Enacted in 2014, HB 4138 provided a pilot program for the customer location apportionment formula. Last year, SB 1523 extended that pilot program. Broadcasters have been filing tax returns and paying taxes for 5 years under the customer location apportionment method. This is providing a reliable and stable revenue stream to Oregon and consistency, certainty, and stability for the taxpayers. Customer location apportionment is consistent with Oregon's enactment in 2017, which was SB 28, of market sourcing for all businesses. It accurately reflects the way income is earned by the networks from our advertisers and our licensees, and provides clarity and consistency to both the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue. It is also consistent with market sourcing principles for sellers of tangible personal property. Without enactment of SB 193, apportionment of broadcasters' income would revert to the outdated audience viewing method. The audience method is problematic for a number of reasons. A lack of information and uncertainty. Many of the companies that distribute the broadcaster's content to viewers, such as satellite distributors and internet streaming services, do not share their state-by-state viewing information with broadcasters. National rating services, such as Nielsen, measure pay television service ratings, but do not provide ratings for internet streaming services. Further, the viewing audience is not a settled matter and leads to contested and time-consuming audits, challenges to the audits, and even litigation, as well as potentially different results for similarly situated taxpayers. Further, it's inconsistent with the principles of market sourcing. Calculating the tax obligation of national broadcast and cable networks based upon audience would assess them on the basis of their customer's customer. The networks have contracts with Oregon-based advertisers and licensees, such as cable companies and local television stations. With the exception of the new over-the-top direct-to-viewer subscription services such as CBS All Access and HBO Go, the national cable and broadcast networks are companies selling at wholesale level. There's no precedent or justification for taxing a wholesaler by looking through to the retailer and its end consumer. I mean, I think the best example here is if a manufacturer of tires is located in State A, and it sells to a distributor in State B, and that distributor sells to a retailer in Oregon. And those sales for the manufacturer of the tire to the distributor are sourced to State B. It's the distributor's sale to the retailer in Oregon that is sourced to Oregon. What audience does is basically, well, you don't tell the manufacturer, we'll source your sales to the distributor based on the number of cars in the state of Oregon versus number of cars in the United States. That's what happens under audience. They, on audit, the Department of Revenue defaults to a population percentage and ignores ratings and ignores any information that we provide. And that's why in those prior years, prior to the law being changed in 2014, we have litigation, extensive litigation, and we are still in litigation. Subsequent, when the customer sourcing was enacted, none of those years, to my knowledge, and from information from any of my member companies have told me, are now the source of any type of litigation. So again, I think the it's proof that the commercial domicile apportionment formula, we've established and recognized our obligation to file tax returns in Oregon, and it's provided a reliable and stable revenue source to the state. Reverting to a viewing audience methodology will create the opposite effect, unpredictability and instability. Many of the broadcast and cable networks will have varying and changing audiences, ensuring that resources, both taxpayers and the Department of Revenue, will have to be expended to establish the audience for many of the different networks. The commercial domicile method is the trend within many states that have revised their apportionment methods. Commercial domicile has been adopted in 6 states since Oregon adopted it in 2014, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Texas, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Kentucky. And prior to Oregon adopting it, commercial domicile was adopted in Michigan, Illinois, and Florida. Taxing national broadcast and cable networks on the basis of their customers, advertisers and licensees, and direct subscribers creates a fair and rational tax system. For these reasons, I respectfully urge the committee to approve SB 193 and continue the customer location method of apportionment. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have at this time.
Thank you. Let me ask you about the Legislative Revenue Office report in 2017. As you can see from our materials today, the report was inconclusive over 3 areas of uncertainty. Which companies are interstate broadcasters, and such and should be apportioned as such. There's uncertainty over the business activities that imply nexus, and there's ongoing disagreement over whether, you know, which part of an income is subject to interstate broadcaster apportionment methods. So those three things, could you address those?
Sure, Chairman. The first two points, I believe that this SB 193, as the law was changed in 2014, eliminates those two issues. All the broadcasters in our group nobody's challenging the definition of interstate broadcasters post 2014 and the adoption of commercial domicile. So that issue is no longer on the table. You will bring it back if we revert back to the old law. The second, again, that issue is also off the table. All of the interstate broadcasters and the broadcasters in our group are filing in Oregon and attributing revenue to the numerator based on those broadcasting activities. So the first two points, I believe, are a great example of why SB 193 is the right answer. The last disagreement is an anomaly that came out of a court case here it really has nothing to do with the specific issue that this bill addresses. What it is the issue of if we're companies that have many legal entities within our groups, and some of those legal entities are involved in businesses that are non-broadcasting activities. And the issue that's come up is that there's been an interpretation under the old rule where the Department of Revenue has said that audience ratio should be applied to all of a broadcaster's revenue, whether it be from broadcasting or in the, what I think is the most egregious example, is to take a broadcasting or a population percentage, let's say 1.2%, and apply it to one of our member companies' theme park revenue in Orlando, Florida. That's what is an issue in those cases, and that's what I believe is the problem, or what this notice by the economists is getting at. And that case, unfortunately, the revenue was all contained in one legal entity. So that issue of how you apply that in a unitary group made up of broadcasters and non-broadcasters was never addressed. So it remains an audit issue, especially on the back years.
Thank you. Senator Boquist?
No, I remember this completely. We've been through this so many times now that.
Senator Benz?
Ditto to Senator Boquist.
Because they did it in the House. I mean, we thought we fixed it once.
Well, the date, the expiration date on the last bill is when?
It goes through tax year 2019.
So we do have some amendments that are in, I think, with legislative counsel. One would change the effective date. There was a drafting error because the customer location commercial domicile expired at the end of last year. So one of those amendments will make it effective January 1 of this year, so there's continuity. So that's a pending amendment. And the other is just to drop the word interstate, and that has to do with, because the definition is about broadcasters, and the word interstate has been in since 2014, but it's superfluous. It's not needed. So just for clarification, and that's really the extent of the amendments that are pending.
And we also think that dropping the word interstate goes along with eliminating the first two points brought up there.
It adds a confusing word. Yeah. Mr. Benz?
Mr. Chair, it would be helpful. Every time I listen to their explanation, it makes perfect sense. But then when we invite the Department of Revenue up, it doesn't. But, so I'd like to hear the Department of Revenue's side of it once for the third time, I think, over the last, I'm going to say, 4 years.
Okay. I'm not sure if the Department of Revenue is prepared to testify today on this bill.
If they don't care, do we care?
Or you don't have your corporate representatives.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
This is a complex issue, and I appreciate you making it so clear. But I've learned that my level of understanding is almost always inadequate to keep up with yours, and therefore the best way for me to understand the issue is to hear both sides of it. I can't think of anyone who could have done a better job than the three of you have in it, well, the two of you have, in explaining where you're coming from, both here and when you explained it in the office again, I think for the at least the third time. Mr. Chair, I would very much like to hear the other side of it. There's big numbers involved here, and
yes.
Yeah.
And so we will hold more hearings on that when we get the, I guess, the right people in the room. We also have no revenue impact on this, and those numbers may be difficult to find because of ongoing litigation, I understand. And for some members of the legislature, those are critical numbers. What's this going to do to Oregon taxpayers one way or the other? And so thank you, three. We will continue this. This is question not the last left. Word. Senator Taylor?
Thank you, Charles. I just want to understand. So will we be getting any estimates? I mean, I do remember this issue from the previous session, but will we be getting any estimates at all about?
We might, and we might not, and we might get an estimate that is indeterminate,
audience,
which is what I think we've had the last couple of sessions on this.
If I may, Chairman and Vice Chair, to the audience or reverting back, it's sort of very anachronistic to use audience. I mean, there was a point in time when audience was a means of sourcing or attributing our income, but that was when there were three networks. And, you know, on Sunday night, 100% of America was watching, you know, Ed Sullivan or Bonanza. Something like that.
Yeah.
In this day and age, what we're finding, you know, especially the audience is so much more dispersed, and there's cord cutting. There's all these different means of accessing our content, mobile devices, and mobility. I mean, some of our programming is viewed worldwide. So it's to ask for even a revenue call on what audience is, it's very different. If you're going to measure the audience for the Super Bowl is a lot different than the audience for Nickelodeon or Comedy Central or some of these niche broadcast networks on cable. And what we have now and what all this litigation is about is a default method of, we'll just use population. And that's not market. Our market is our customer. Our customer is our licensee. If we sell programming to Netflix, we get a license fee, a flat fee from Netflix. It has nothing to do with audience. And we're paid. And we don't have any information about Netflix users. That's proprietary data that they keep very close to the vest. So I just, I think that, yes, you could project very, very big revenue losses on imaginary numbers. They're not real because you're just using a population of Oregon as if every television show or every piece of content that we create is viewed by 1.2% of the country, and they're all in Oregon. So, and this method works. My company is under audit for 1 year under the old, 2 years under the new. The 2 years under this method, there's no issues. It's in our books and records. He has all the information. We've broken it out in a 50-state breakout, and the auditor is like, that's it. In the old rule, we provide ratings, and the department just disregards ratings information that we provide to them because the number's too low. Not what the legislature enacted, not what the regulation says, just because the number's too low. We've had hearing offices very sympathetic to our point of view, to the ratings. I've had all the information. I have it here. So
So,
yes, you're going to get, you want to hear the other side, Vice Chair Benz. I welcome. I also welcome discussing it informally next to them, because if they can find out where our audience is and they have this information, it's information that Amazon, Netflix, and nobody else is providing.
So I'm so inadequately prepared for what you are presenting. It's not on us to be able to ask you the appropriate, at least me, the appropriate questions of you, because I simply don't know them. I could hazard wild guesses and embarrass myself. I don't choose to do that. What I'd rather have, or any more than I already have, what I'd rather have happen is people who are knowledgeable about the topic from the other side come in and explain it to us. And then we can listen. So it's not on you. I mean, good job. You've done great. Now I want to hear the other side. It's a matter of having educated people explain to me what the issue truly is. Pretty simple. And just to say, your argument on the audience is excellent. I like it. I don't know a thing about the location apportionment method or its quantification or how well it works or any part of it. I'm not sure it's even on the table. But I don't need to wander into that morass. I can wait until somebody shows up that actually knows about it. There. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think there is some sympathy in keeping our state consistent with the policy of destinations, sales in our state, and that's truly my desire too. But I think part of what makes this so hard is that this technology is changing so quickly. I mean, your industry is so much different today than it was 5 years ago, much less 25 years ago. And, you know, we're watching movies on phones and subscribing to companies that didn't exist a few years ago. And so that's part of the hurdle here. So we thank you for your information.
Mr. Chairman, can I say just one thing?
Yes.
Again, John Powell representing the Motion Picture Association of America. I think that this is complex, and you can just get turned around your axle. It's taken me 2 years, and I still have to get under my car with my pocket knife and cut the straw off my axle. So it is complex, but if you boil it down, it is what you said. It's either a market-based approach or cutting through the wholesaler that they sell to and taxing them based on a theoretical audience. And if you do that, they will pay more. It's like if everyone whose last name was Powell was added to my tax return, their income was, I would pay more. But those people, I have nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in this situation. The revenue stream of a theme park in Florida or at Disneyland or places like that fall into these formulas. And naturally, you would pay more if those are put into the formula. And you're getting the tax revenue. When they license to Comcast here, and I'm a subscriber, what I pay Comcast, which between my house and office is about $600 a month, is taxed in Oregon. It's sourced to Oregon. So the fact that they used to throw signals up in the air and people put up their antenna and grab them, bypassing, there were no middlemen.
So you're still getting
revenue from the retailer who's selling directly to the customer. So it's not like all that revenue is gone, because it's not.
And if I may add, ironically, our industry is moving direct to consumer. Disney is going to come out with a direct to consumer offering on a subscription basis. So this all becomes moot, basically. It'll just be based sourcing on this. And this actually, this SB captures it as you use, if it's an individual, use the billing address of the subscriber. So our industry is actually moving to eliminating the middleman, if you will. And we have CBS All Access, HBO on the go, HBO Go, and I believe Comcast is coming out with an offering this year. We already have Netflix and Amazon who are, you know, have basically given a wake-up call to our whole industry. So if anything, the trend is moving to direct-to-consumer, and the cord cutting is well on its way. So just sort of the audience is, I mean, the old method is sort of an old battle, and this is really the new world.
And the customer location actually captures that, because the customer for a streaming service is the end viewer, is the audience. So this customer location, what we're asking to continue, takes care of both. Takes care of the current system where we are the wholesaler, right, but also where we are the direct supplier to the viewer. So it will work for both. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. I have Maureen Barnhart signed up.
Because I have given testimony before that I signed up on the wrong sheet, but thank you anyway.
Okay. All right, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 193. We will revisit this. Thank you, Caitlin. I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 702. Is this factored into this number? Jamie?
So when you take your state's percentage, let's say it's 2% of total American sales, times that number.
I got something that I don't want anybody to know. Like you.
Can you give us a briefing on this bill, please? A little history, set the stage.
Sure.
Tell us a story.
Story time. Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Many people are aware that the property tax system in Oregon is based on what's called Measure 5 and Measure 50, set some now decades ago, that established that Oregon property taxes are based on an assessed value. And there's also limits placed on the amount of growth that the assessed value can have at 3% in general terms. And then there's also caps on permanent rates for the property taxes. Some people have argued that increasingly there's a disparity in the property taxes paid by owners of similar properties, both in business arenas and residential properties. I've only been at the Legislative Revenue Office for approximately a year and a half, but it's my understanding that multiple times bills and conversations have come up regarding the property tax system in Oregon. And so Senate Bill 702 directs the Legislative Revenue Officer to conduct a set of studies on land value taxation as compared to the current property tax system in Oregon, while specifically considering impacts when designed as a revenue neutral system change, what the local impacts would be, and what effects something like homestead exemptions would have. And in this study that would be directed, the idea of land value taxation would be that the property, the land, would be taxed differently than the improvements that would go on that land. And I think that in Senate Bill 702, that refers to the land being taxed at a higher rate than the improvements. And the commentary in the bill, it discusses removing discouraging tax rates on improvements on potentially things like infill properties. So
Okay, Senator Boquist, you brought this bill forward. Did you want to say any words?
Certainly. I think we had Senate Bill 7, SB 711 yesterday, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Continuing on that theme of property tax reform.
And as I mentioned, you know, my eyes bugged out in 2012 and 2013 looking at the GSI, the GIS data of who would vote for and against and why we didn't put a 50 or something repeal from 2013. And there are individuals in this room who really, really want to do something about this and have for multiple years. And of course, all five of us serve at the pleasure of somebody else. And we might actually wake up one morning and say, this is not a smart place to be and not come back. Mm-hmm. This is the insurance policy once again, because we've done this once before, to say, we actually already study this internally, but we create the formal mechanism to do this so that when we either do something and succeed, we of course don't need this 2 years from now, or if we don't do it and you don't come back or I don't come back and somebody else is here, we are now at least in the position to continue to have the discussion of how do we fix the tale of two houses. And so once again here, I have sponsored this, as you know, once before. We actually already do most of this in-house. We've had people come up and say, well, you need to continue to study this. I don't know, frankly, whether we're going to succeed or fail this session, but if we fail this session, then we need to continue to study this. And we can't assume that our colleagues that replace the five of us on this thing 2 years from now are going to be as enthused about doing something as we are. And I think I'm on the record, because my good colleague reminded me I was on the record a day ago and said, we realize this is broke. We are interested in working for a solution. And so that is why we have this before. There are some groups that have sponsored this before who have probably as much faith as I do that we'll actually do something this session. So therefore, they want to make sure we're prepared 2 years from now. So there we go in a nutshell. Okay. I am willing to work on it this session, and if it doesn't work, I'm just as willing to make sure we have all of the stuff for the next group of fine revenue committee members to try and address this issue.
Okay. When your colleague reminded you you were on the record, is that like my kids telling me, you know, Dad, you said that out loud?
It is a similar thing, but I'm trying to humor you, Mr. Chair, because, you know, there are not all things we agree upon. This just happens to be one that we all agree that somehow we need to fix the two houses, and it's really not the two houses that are preventing this.
All right, Chris Nielsen and Tom Gehring.
For the record, I'm Chris Nelson with Common Ground, Oregon, Washington, in Portland. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, since this committee passed a longer version of the bill in 2015, we've streamlined the provisions to help ensure that there is no fiscal impact for this study. In this session, we actually omitted the provision that would analyze tax abatement on improvements. And we're also confident that the Legislative Revenue Office will complete the study as specified in the bill without a fiscal impact. And we're really intent, I think, that this bill make findings on the economic incentive effects of a land-weighted property tax available as soon as possible so that legislators can consider the policy options to craft a permanent fix to our problems and broken property tax limitations. As legislators well know, measures 5 and 50 have thoroughly created widespread economic distortions and inconsistent property tax obligations statewide. And our study of Salem's early experience with the property tax limitations and maximum assessed values showed that tax burdens have shifted off of rapidly appreciating properties and onto slower growing or even decreasing assessed values. So statewide, the effect has been to shift tax burden off of other sectors onto the residential properties. Because Measure 5 limitations have caused local levies to go uncollected, fixing compression alone really leaves out this underlying unfairness of Measure 50. And moreover, leaving the equal rates unaddressed, as we have now, misses this big disincentive that we're under to invest in capital improvements. The statewide lack of housing supply is really evidence of this penalty that the equal rates wage. Then what are the core issues that we need to assess to provide a smooth transition from the woes of Measures 5 and 50 to a local option land value tax? Well, the Legislative Revenue Office would study several questions, including how can relief measures best be designed for homeowners that experience large tax increases resulting from the return to real market values? Phasing in a two-tiered tax rates over many years will minimize precipitous increases. A tax deferral until sale would also afford relief. And as mentioned earlier, another option is to consider a homestead exemption on land value up to a reasonable amount. And secondly, what would be the revenue-generating effects of a land value taxation on overlapping taxing districts? This, depending on the overall assessment ratio of land to improvements, some districts might experience a decrease in revenues while others experience an increase compared to an equal rate tax. And thirdly, using real market values, how would rural and urban communities experience economic incentive effects? Well, the longer we delay in tackling these thorny questions, the greater the opportunity cost to these struggling communities that could unleash productivity gains clearly available if the two-rate incentive tax system were in practice. We ask you to support this bill as the means of bringing about proven prosperity for businesses, homeowners, and local government. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify before this committee today. My name is Tom Gearing. I'm the research director for Common Ground, Oregon, Washington chapter. Several of you are now already familiar with land value taxation. We've talked about it a number of years in the past and we're continuing to. You know it in the abstract, but you would like to know how it works in practice. So this bill, 702, conducts a study of the incentive and equity effects of a land value tax on properties in Oregon's cities and towns. This bill is the first step towards a comprehensive reform of Oregon's broken property tax system. The next step is to remove the tax rate and assessment limits from the state constitution and put any kind of limitations as this into a statute where they really belong, not in the Constitution. The third is following this would be a local option exemption from the limitations of Measure 5 and 50. For those Oregon communities, counties that choose to adopt this method of taxation, and a return to real market assessments. This would correct some of the inequities that we find in the current property tax system that have accumulated over the past 25 years, where property owners in similar circumstances see very different tax bills. Alone, however, this would not correct the inequitable or adverse incentives that occur when land and improvements are taxed at the same rate. Just as Chris was alluding to before, raising taxes on owners who choose to make capital investments in their property. In other words, to put land into production, their tax rates or their tax bills would increase. This is the reverse incentive than what we really want to see. We want to see land in production, more and more residences built on land where land is available to build new multifamily and single-family residence. The final step would be to introduce the land value tax and a split rate on land and improvements. As you suggest, the rate would be higher on land, lower on improvements. This would bring the incentive to bring land into production and to bring property to its highest and best use. This will alleviate the unfairness of the current system and the economic distortions that are currently the case under the equal rate system and certainly under the system that we have of property tax limitations. So we would like to see this bill passed so that you and your fellow representatives and senators would be able to understand and see how the land value tax and these kinds of reforms that we were just describing would take place and what kind of decisions you would make as far as implementing the property tax reforms in the state.
Thank you both. I think, you know, my money, I'm with you in spirit in terms of the incentives and eliminating distortions. You know, one of the things we struggle, part of the struggle we have, when we were discussing property taxes the other day, was whatever change we make has to go to voters. And it is such a complicated issue. And now you want to change that issue. So in addition to finding the right policy, we also have to find ways to get a yes vote. And I'm just wondering, just curious how you put that into your computation here. We have to get a yes vote from, 2 million voters.
Yes, we understand. We understand that. Hopefully, voters will understand that this is a much fairer system, and it does encourage people to utilize their land. And those who want to make improvements to their property will stand to benefit. The question is a groundswell of voters. I understand that. This has been implemented in other states, and it's worked well, especially in Pennsylvania, as some of you already know.
This is Chair Haas and Vice Chair, members of the committee, if I might just mention, in response, I think once people have the opportunity to also see adequate provisions to enable a transition to real market values, let's face it, there are some awful cases out there of huge gaps between assessed values and real market values. So to the extent that we can accommodate these hardship cases and, you know, provide assurance, real assurance, that they are not going to experience skyrocketing tax bills in this transition, if we don't cover that base, I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, the land value tax, I think, would be introduced in such a way that the split rates would begin at a fairly low level. In other words, you might start with 60% of the tax rate on land and 40% on improvements, and then gradually work up to a level which is like 90% of the tax rate on land. But it would transition over a period of time.
Okay, and we think we can do this without a fiscal impact?
And maybe this time we'll do it. Any questions, Senator Benz?
Sure, one, Mr. Chair. The key elements of any of these analyses, there's two additional. You kind of touched upon one, which is if you make any transition, there's got to be a benefit for everybody. So that has to be called out. And mere equity is not going to be enough. And then the second one is, I think it unlikely that people are going to enthusiastically embrace a new system without some sort of limit built into it. So where's the limit? So these are things looking forward. I just throw them out because we're having a general discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right.
No, I just want to point out that, you know, we've been talking about the ills of 5 and 50 since I was elected and first met good Representative Benz down there, elected the same year, I believe, okay? And we haven't gotten anywhere. So I am, as my normal case here, let's start looking at all particular options. And I just point out to you that we all know when you look at the cities and counties, they're sort of restricted on what they can support, not support, or moral support, or whatever. And when you can get outside groups that are grassroots groups to say, hey, we need to do this, we're now in a playing field that we might have an opportunity to get something that was viable moving. And so unless we're going to, you know, fix this in the next 3 months and put it on the ballot, I would prefer to have as many options back on the table, you know, in 18 months from now, if we succeed or fail. Because we could even put something on the ballot, I'm just being optimistic, rare for me, right, Senator Benz, that we put something on the ballot and then it fails. So, and we know whatever we put on the ballot at this point has to have so many carrots in it, it's not going to be what we really want to do anyway. So.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 702. And we are going to do a couple of work sessions here. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 162. This is the checkoff bill on 529 savings. Cal's here to remind us. We have no amendments. We do. I'm sorry.
So yes, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 162, we do have the dash one amendment. And again, the dash one is in response to some concerns that were raised during the public hearing when both Treasury and Department of Revenue more or less discussed how this process would work. So the general idea with the dash one amendment to the bill is when a taxpayer files their income tax return, they would have the ability at that time to essentially elect to open a 529 account, with the idea being the Department of Revenue can then share such information that's on the return with the department or with Treasury, who can then start the process of opening a new 529 higher education savings account. There are some difficulties in actually having the account open automatically and such, and so that language is the language is adjusted in the dash one to really it's more about starting the process rather than making it happen instantaneously and then applying the tax refund to it. The tax refund language being used to start the 529 program has been removed as well. So again, it's really more of a notification process to Treasury that someone is interested, and then sharing what information can be at that time that the return is filed. The fiscal is minimal, and the revenue impact is also minimal.
Questions of Kyle on the amendment? The Treasurer's office is here standing by. Okay, Senator Benz.
Mr. Chair, what's the date on the amendment? Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to SB 162 dated 2/2019.
Senator Benz moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 162. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the dash ones are added.
I move SB 162 as amended to the floor.
Senator Benz moves Senate Bill 162 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate as amended. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Chair Haas?
Chair House votes aye, and I think I better be careful here, and I wanted to declare a potential conflict as my employer does business with the state treasury. Measure passes, and Senator Bentz, we're down to you. Would you mind carrying this bill on the floor?
Happy to do so.
Okay. We have a bill to introduce. Chris, do you want to give us a quick rundown on what you want to do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. This is a bit of deja vu. This legislative concept is tied to the federal changes in corporate taxation. If you recall, in 2018, there was a chance for a double deduction related to repatriation payments. There's a chance that situation may occur again related to so-called GILTI payments at the federal level. We're still working with experts to figure out if there is a problem. There are different opinions about that right now. This bill would just be a vehicle to address that issue.
Okay. Do you have an LC number, Senator Bentz?
You said 3547. Okay. Yeah. Sure, I move LC 3547 be admitted as a committee bill.
Senator Bentz moves LC 3547 to be introduced as a revenue committee bill. Any discussion? Senator Boquist?
I just want to make the reflection that a LC introduced by the committee doesn't necessarily mean agreement or disagreement, and this is a future placeholder so we can have this discussion.
Other discussion? Seeing none. Are there any objections to this bill introduction? Seeing none, LC 3547 will be introduced as a committee bill. All right. Thank you, committee. That takes care of everything. We are adjourned.